Welcome to the 26th episode of Extra Sequential, a podcast coming at ya from Perth in Western Australia, all about comics and pop culture goodness. And my name is Chris.
My name's Mladen, and in this week's show, we're going to be dissecting action in comics.
How Action Jackson.
No, we'll be dissecting how action's actually portrayed in comics. When you're thinking about it, you're looking at unmoving pictures, so there's a lot going on behind the scenes that we're going to pick apart, see what works, what doesn't, and kind of compare trends through history and kind of the East-West influence as well. There's actually a lot in there. And it's not really going to be our choice of great action scenes. We can save that for another show, I think. It's going to be looking at, well, hopefully we won't embarrass ourselves and dissect.
Maybe a little bit.
Maybe just a little. Me especially. This topic was my idea, so if it falls flat on my face, you only have me to blame.
I would never do that.
Yeah, I know.
Let's talk about the news.
Yeah, all right. I could only think of one news item this week as well, and I'm hoping we've got the same one in mind.
Yes.
Is that it?
John Williams has died?
Yes.
No, Henry Cavill is Superman in the new Superman movie, just been announced this very week.
Hunky Henry.
As you like to call him, as you hang out at the local tavern. Now, I'm not familiar with Henry Cavill's work, but I think you've seen him on The Tudors.
That's correct. The John Rhys-Meyers historical kind of sexy Tudors, as it's sometimes referred to, playing fast and loose of history, but adding on the sex.
Wow. Yeah. That's what you need to do, apparently, in these every successful TV show is sex.
If you don't want to be cancelled, yeah.
So he's a British actor. He's 6'1". He's 27 years old, and apparently he was up for Superman a couple of years ago when McGee, the Charlie's Angels director, was going to direct the Superman reboot off a J.J. Abrams script. It's called Flyby, which was atrocious, which had Lex Luthor as a Superman's Kryptonian brother and all kind of scragey shenanigans. So he was originally one of the top choices for that, but thankfully that film never got made. So yeah, this is the film that we're talking about. It's going to be released in December 2012, and it is directed by what's his face? Zach Whedon.
Bob Hoskins? Steve Carell.
Zack Snyder, who directed 300 and Watchmen, and Sucker Punch, which should be coming out soon as well. So it should be interesting. We don't know what it's called. We don't know a lot of details as yet, but he looks the part.
I'm going to guess they're going to call it The Superman.
Or Superman Reborn or Superman Man of Steel are the other two options.
It's become way more cool these days just to put a "the" in front of things, like The Fast and Furious or whatever it's called now. Fast and Furious?
Yes, and I think the next one is called Fast Five, which sounds like some kind of Hardy Boys adventure.
They're just losing patience with these titles. I think the next one after that will just be called Fast.
Five is Alive. So is he a good actor, this Cavill fellow?
I've only seen him on Tudors, and he's pretty good in that. I mean, the show is a little bit melodrama, but he's actually quite good in it. And I think he looks the part in my mind when I picture him. And he can sport rugged and clean shaven, you know. So I reckon he could do either.
He's a man of belly talents.
I know, right? He's very GQ.
Yes. Okay. Yep.
Yeah, but like respectable GQ, not like he's not Jude Law GQ. He's on the
Jude Law's respectable, apart from the sleeping with the nanny.
No, he's respect. Yeah, well, he's respectable, but he's not what you'd call manly.
No, that's true. He's slightly on the effeminate scale,
if we're being fair. Yeah, but Jude Law is like, I don't like to just classify him as a pretty boy, because he is, but remember that film he was, I think it's Road to Perdition, remember his character in that?
Yes, he was quite ugly, and wasn't he balding or something?
Yeah, he was balding on top, he had really bad teeth, and he played vicious bastard really well, and he didn't look pretty at all, so I'm like, okay, he uglied himself up, it's kind of like Monster's Ball or something. Is that the one I'm thinking of? No, not Monster's Ball.
No,
the other one.
Monster. Charlize Theron, and she won the Oscar.
Monster's Ball has Billy Bob Thornton, my favourite actor, I think.
Yes, Billy Bob Thornton, and I think Heath Ledger was in that as well.
Oh, really? Okay. See? I won't say it.
You don't like Ledger?
I don't like, Billy Bob.
Oh, okay, yeah. He went from, like, indie success to kind of starring in Armageddon and...
And he was in a Hugh Grant movie or something, wasn't he? No, he was in Love Actually, I think, wasn't he? He was like the president.
Oh, yeah, he played the president, yeah.
Opposite Hugh Grant, yeah. There was like Tony Blair and then like that other guy. I don't want to talk about Billy Bob Thornton for the whole episode. But if that's the only news we had...
Yeah, pretty much.
It's so sad. Points for research, folks. Let's get into what we've been reading then.
I watched Scott Pilgrim vs. the World again last night on double disc DVD.
Again?
It had a whole bunch of features, and there was maybe 20 deleted scenes, which I didn't watch all of them.
Yeah.
And there's a bunch of commentaries on there as well, which I haven't listened to, but there was one of the deleted scenes was an alternate ending.
I was going to ask if you watched that. Yeah.
I did. And basically, Michael Cera... Yeah.
Spoilers for an alternate universe version of Scott Pilgrim vs. the World.
But I can see why they dropped it. Basically, Ramona Flowers, who was the object of affection throughout all of Michael Cera's, or Scott Pilgrim's, the film, and he had to basically beat up her seven evil exes to win her affection. She walks off alone at the end of the film, and Scott Pilgrim gets back together with 17-year-old Chinese schoolgirl Knives Chow, and I can understand why he would, but it seemed like quite an odd ending to even film because he spends the whole hour and a half chasing Ramona Flowers and then the last 5 minutes to not choose her.
I think I'm going to have to disagree with you here. I actually prefer the alternate ending because the whole film is him, he's chasing after this girl, but the final, if you remember how he replays the final action scenes, the whole point is that he does it for himself. He's not fighting for her the second time around.
Yeah, that's true. He earns the power of self-respect.
Yeah, and I sort of took that as a nice cue of, she was the prize, and then he sort of grows up, which is a nice way to look at the alternate ending. I mean, it probably would... If for that to make sense, he shouldn't have ended up with knives either, but...
That's true. It's not a Hollywood ending as such, so...
It's probably why it probably didn't test well for that reason, but I wouldn't fault it. It's nice to watch both, I think.
Yeah, it is a good film. Have you been watching or reading anything, my friend?
I have been, or I watched Once Upon a Time in the West, the Sergio Leone film just after The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly.
Okay.
Stars Charles Bronson as Harmonica. He's like a nameless wanderer who plays this creepy harmonica thing. And Henry Fonda, who normally plays the good guy in all sorts of films, Striking Blue Eyes. I don't know if you remember the actor. But
Jane Fonda's father?
Husband
or something?
Father, I think, yeah. And he is the villain. And at the beginning of the film, he shoots a child in the back. It's pretty awesome film. Oh, and it's got a real hottie on board, because these are spaghetti westerns. They got this sultry Italian actress called Claudia Cardinale or something like that.
Okay.
She's awesome. But otherwise, it's a really cool film. Great soundtrack by Ennio Morricone. And that's like just the whole package, beautifully shot, great cinematography. Of all the Sergio Leone films I've seen, it's probably my favorite so far. And it's long, though, so I watched it in two sittings, which may have helped.
Carry on.
No, I was going to say I'd be pretty tired trying to watch the whole thing, but I would definitely recommend it to anyone who's curious about Westerns, because I don't normally watch them, but this has piqued my interest to watch more of them, so that's a good sign.
I was actually cleaning desks this week at work. We were moving pretty much all the office around, and I found the best of... Ennio Morricone or whatever his name is, CD on somebody's desk, like his best Western soundtrack.
That's cool.
Because he's got quite a good reputation, that fellow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I'm trying to think what other films he'd... I feel like he's done other films, but I just can't place the non-Western ones in my head. I know I've heard them, but I... Oh, no. He played with electronic stuff for a while as well.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he's had quite a broad, varied career. Great sound. Great driving music, I find. Play those, like, especially in Australia, if you're driving anywhere on our outback roads, those kind of sweeping Western themes, haunting, desolate environments, it goes together really well.
Hopefully that keep you awake as well on those long, winding roads.
It makes me just want to run over Mexicans.
Yeah, we don't have too many of those here.
Fine. Cowboys. Hitchhikers. We have cowboys. I'll run over some cowboys.
Yes.
As long as they're, like, bad guys. They have to wear black. If they're wearing black, then I know.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah.
Talking about bad guys wearing black, I have been reading Darth Vader and the Lost Command. It's from Dark Horse. It's a 40-page first issue of a 5-issue miniseries, obviously a Star Wars comic, written by Hayden Blackman, who's done quite a fair bit of Star Wars stuff, and also Conan for Dark Horse. And he's also, I believe, he's co-writing the Batwoman series, which I think is starting with J.H. Williams III, should be starting next month. And Rick Leonardi pencils, does the art for it. Basically, it's set pretty soon after Revenge of the Sith. And a lot of people have been talking about the first, I think it's the first 5 or 6 pages, which are pretty awesome. Basically, you have Anakin, you know, I think he's basically just a torso, and he's got like 4 stumps. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the stumps is better than the other. He's got like a slightly longer arm, because if you remember in the lava pit, and Obi-Wan like does this fancy slice as he tries to force jump over him.
You mean the lava planet, the single geothermic landmass planet?
That's the one.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you remember how Anakin ends up with, well, pretty much no arms and no legs. So it starts pretty awesomely. He's basically just cradled, this almost naked Anakin is cradled and is all scarred and limbless, just, you know, with ropes kind of holding him up to the ceiling, and all robots putting his armor on him after like a routine maintenance. And I think that might even be the first time in any, well, as far as I can recall, that we've seen Anakin outside of the armor, like, he's full-bodied, if you know what I mean. So that was pretty cool. And he's basically, Anakin is like, because it hurts so much, this routine maintenance, and he's checking the nerve impulses and all that, that he's using his memories of Padme. Sounds like an Italian pastor when I say it, but he's using his memories of Natalie Portman to kind of see him through the pain.
Guess he shouldn't have killed her then.
Yeah, I know, it's a bit weird, isn't it? But he's a bad guy, so he's probably has filled with regret, even though it was an accidental death. He just choked
a pregnant woman, yeah. Just an accident. He's like a abusive husband.
I knew what was wrong when I was doing it.
I hate you.
Then the Emperor gives Darth Vader a mission to find a missing Imperial force that's gone, well, yeah, missing. So it's pretty interesting because it's Darth Vader doesn't have the scary reputation throughout the galaxy that he does in the, that we see in the original films.
Okay.
Episodes 4 to 6. So he's kind of getting a bit of back chat from the Emperor, and, you know, the other kind of Imperial officers don't really believe in him. Moff Tarkin is there. Moff Tarkin's son is one of the officers that's missing. So basically Vader's kind of charged to go and find this, and it's pretty good. And Moff Tarkin saying, you better do this, you know, you have yet to prove yourself. So not everybody's afraid of Darth Vader, so that's pretty cool. And it's got a couple of good fight scenes in it. There's one where Vader uses the force to create this blizzard, because it's on like a snow planet like Hoth, and he blinds all the enemy snipers, and then they cut them all down with their lightsabers and guns and stuff. So yeah, it's pretty good. If you like Star Wars, Darth Vader and the Lost Command, Dark Horse have been pretty good, you know, with the
they've Star done Wars a good job with that license. Yeah, they keep like at least trying out new ideas and stuff. But yeah, I've just never been convinced by that kind of blending of the prequel films to the modern ones. It seems kind of
really.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, you see it in The Force Unleashed as well, you know, that video game?
Yeah.
I think there's a comic based on that as well, isn't there?
Yeah, there was, and that was just as bad as the game.
Yeah, I'm just, like, just not... It seems like technology keeps stepping back, and it's like, well, why? But I was just thinking when you said, oh, they're not scared of him yet. I love in the first Star Wars film how the guy makes fun of his religion. Do you remember your faith in that dying religion has not helped you conjure the stolen data tapes? And then he chokes him.
Yes. Yeah.
That smarmy guy.
Yep.
So I guess still not everyone had heard of him. But then later on, they're all terrified of him. I guess because he chokes people who don't pay attention to him.
Yeah, he does that a lot, doesn't he? He probably kills more people by choking them than he does with his lightsaber.
It's a cheaper special effect.
Choking costs nothing.
Now I'm thinking like a director. Yeah.
Yes. Good work.
Yeah.
That's all I've been reading, my friend.
Yeah, I don't think I read any comics. In preparation for this, I actually reread some of the comics I'm going to be talking about. And because I'll be breaking it down later, I will just mention I reread We Three.
Ah, yes, good work.
Yeah, which is a book I read so many years ago when I was first getting into comics, and now rereading it again, I have more appreciation for it, kind of looking at other comics it's up against. It's quite novel, not just the story, but how it's told, like stuff you don't even really think, consider while you're reading it. But there's some crazy stuff going on with panel layouts and
yes,
yeah.
Written by Grant Morrison, art by Frank Whiteley. Mm. Animals, cybernetic, experimented on, go nuts and kill lots of people.
Yeah, it's kind of awesome. Marlowe Notice. It is. Adults. Yeah, well, for like teenagers who like blood and gore as well. Adults. Yes. Yeah. It's quite enjoyable, and because it's animals, you feel way more sorry for them than you would for humans in the same situation. And when that, I don't want to spoil it. But when a certain character dies, it's devastating.
Yeah.
And considering it's an animal, it's like, no!
Like you're Bambi's mom.
It's on that level, except more pathetic, so it's worse. It's like, oh, man. Oh, I love that reveal of the pit bull. But anyway, that's the one scene I remember the most vividly from the first time I read it. Like, and when you first see that, you're like, oh, geez, this is going to be massive. It's a cool comic, Chris.
It is. It's very cool, and it's very cool to give to people. Like, if they've never read comics before.
There's no punching in it. There's scratching.
There's lots of eyes flying and...
Yeah. It's quite... Yeah. Anyone who's like, give us a cool comic. I like... I don't know. It's not like Quentin Tarantino, but, you know, dudes who like those kind of films, or... I don't know. Yeah. I think they'd get a real kick out of We Three. But, yeah. And Frank Whiteley deserves much more kudos. I think that's a really great combination, those two together.
Yes, they've done. They just stopped working on Batman and Robin, actually. So they don't work together that often, but when they do, the sparks fly and something beautiful is created.
Yeah, I think that's a combo we'll be looking back on like 20 years from now, going, "Wow, what a great body of work!" Kind of
definitely
together. Yeah, so that's all I've been reading. I'm going to dig into that Philip K. Dick adaptation soon, but I'll talk about that another week because I'm intrigued by it. Because have you read it yet?
I've read the we're talking about the Boom Studios.
Boom Studios, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep?
Yes, I read, because it's a word for word one, and I did read the first issue, and obviously it is quite wordy.
It's very jarring, yeah.
But it's interesting. It takes a while to get used to because it's like it's almost like a novel with pictures.
Yeah, it makes me think of very old comics in the days where they'd narrate everything. You know, like Joker picked up the pen on the table and you see him doing it. So it's like, why do I need... That's what it just makes me think of, that like it's a step back. So it's maybe it'd be more comfortable someone in the 1940s to read it. But
I think you just need to choose what art you show very wisely.
Yeah, but they put every single line of word in the novel into the comic adaptation.
They do, and it's a very long adaptation. I think it's like 2 years. Yeah, it's like 24 issues or something ridiculous.
It's an entire novel split up into pages. So if you imagine how many pages there are on a novel page, and each page then has to be, you know, several comic pages long. Oh gosh, so they might have bitten off more than they can chew with this project. But there you go.
Well, they're over the halfway mark, so they seem to be doing okay so far.
Yeah, they're still publishing it. The worry is, on my end, they're just going to give up after a point and stop publishing it.
I shouldn't think so. I'd imagine there'd be a lot of purists, like a non-comic readers, that would get into something like this.
It's like an illustrated version of the novel, isn't it? It's kind of like...
Yeah.
Yeah, which is... you don't see much anymore, but novels used to have woodblock illustrations and, you know, that kind of thing every couple of pages, and that's more what this reminds me of, except every line has an illustration. So, it's kind of crazy. Craziness.
Well, yes.
That's all I have.
All right, well, let's talk about action.
Action in comics. I guess if you put the in like in brackets, then it's just action comics. And I think that's what a lot of people think of when they think of comics. I know I myself think of superheroes punching each other.
I was just going to say the same thing. When you first mentioned this, I was like, well, yeah, that's the first thing that came to mind. But I've done some just research, I guess. Just reading comics that I've got over the decades and just kind of taking random samples. And I was kind of surprised how little in comics these days superheroes actually fight each other.
Yeah, it's been interesting to sort of, and how long the fights go on for, because just look through my like studies of flipping through, say, it's a different manga and different American comics, noticing how many pages a fight will go for, how many panels it's broken up into, and the rhythm you get from that. I mean, we're not talking about like action. It's not like action movies where there's an expectation of a certain amount of action. As you said, like superhero comics, there's less fighting than ever. So it's either...
Yeah.
And I suspect it's in part because action... You do want a bit of action in your comic, but too much can be tiresome. And I've got some examples here of comics which are just action. And some of them are very tiresome. But I suppose we could start by sort of just comparing... I mean, when people think of action, you do think film. I do mainly. And you can see a bit of crossover between comics and film in that a lot of comic book artists sort of work as if they're creating storyboards on their panels.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think film obviously has that freer, has more freedom to explore an action scene, which is far more exciting. And the comic book artist maybe has to work a bit harder to get your attention and keep your attention for an extended fight scene. And there's different techniques they use, and we can go into those. But I mean, you see a bit of back and forthing. I mean, the earliest examples we were looking through, and just to help myself research, I was looking through a very the very useful, you know, the greatest Batman stories ever told, DC.
Oh, okay, yeah. Yes.
There's a Joker one as well, but the Batman one had a better range of years, I thought. And it's been very kind of enlightening just to look at the very first ones, and that's, I know you've looked at some old ones as well, and how they're staged. The whole comics are staged like theatre plays, and the fights are the same way. It's standing back, it's looking at the characters, they're both sort of centred in the panel, and there's a lot of dialogue. It's not particularly exciting, one would say.
No, I was just talking about Batman. I was actually, right now, as we speak, I'm looking at the death of Jason Todd.
Okay.
And
that's not that long ago.
No, that's, 1988, but I think it hasn't aged that well. But this is in Batman issue 428. Jason Todd was the second Robin, and basically he wasn't that popular with readers, so DC opened up a vote to either keep him alive or to kill him, and readers voted to kill him. So that's what happened in this issue in 1988. Basically the page where he actually dies, it's basically a whole page of Joker with a crowbar just hammering him on the head, and it's the same page. It's a mid-shot of Joker full on.
Yeah.
Joker's wearing like a pink jumpsuit, and it's just moving the crowbar up and down like there's no... And I was just thinking, if that was to be done today, you'd have like a close-up of the blood on the crowbar. You'd have like a silhouette of a blood spray. You'd have
Joker's
bloodshot eyes, you know what I mean? Whereas this, it actually looks quite static. Joker just moving the crowbar up and down. You've got speed lines indicating that he's doing so. Then compare that with something... earlier, say like Kraven the Hunter death. Kraven the Hunter is a classic Spider-Man villain. He kind of, basically he's a hunter, and he had this huge drive to basically want to kill Spider-Man. And I think it was called Kraven's Last Hunt, I think it was, the story arc. And so basically he captures Spider-Man, and that's like his life's purpose done, so he decides to kill himself. And it's basically, and this actually works, even though it's the same era, 1987, but he's got like a shotgun. You see the close-ups of the hand of the shotgun. There's a crack of lightning outside his window. There's a silhouette of him with a shotgun in his mouth. There's him with the thumb on the trigger. There's another lightning shot, so you never actually see the shotgun blow off. And then he falls. You don't see his body. You don't see his head. You just see him fall down into a coffin. Yeah. And then you see blood splatter on his family portrait. And that's only, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 panels on a page, all different sizes, horizontal and vertical, with some sound effects, hardly any text. But it works. It's spooky, and that works a lot better than, say, the Joker beating the Batman to death, even though, you know, we may not think action, someone committing suicide by a shotgun.
I suppose we should have said that at the beginning, that action doesn't have to be two people punching each other. Action is any kind of struggle, especially expressed physically, which can be a chase, it can be... someone trying to kill themselves if there's like a tension in the in the physical movement. But we do have to kind of tighten it, because you do see certain types of action over and over again. With the Jason Todd example you mentioned there, I do remember those exact panels. And I agree with you, it's not quite as effective as it should be. And it might be, I sort of wonder if, I mean, it's a difference between, it's an objective view. You're viewing him doing, even though it's fairly tight in on like a mid-range shot, you're not actually in the action. You're still watching it happen.
That is true, but I'm thinking, because I know this, and this is probably in the comics, this would have been a Comics Code approved issue as well, I'd imagine, in the late 80s. And this got so much mainstream press at the time because everyone thought they were killing the original Robin from the TV series. So, but if you see it now, it's a lot more bloody, even if you see like the recent animated film, Batman Under the Red Hood, and the comics that it's based upon, where they kind of show the flashback to Jason Todd being killed like this. Mm-hmm. It's a lot more brutal and it's a lot more bloody now, I guess because, well, I don't know, comics have grown up.
That does make sense. It's not something I'd considered. It's actually a fairly good point, because I know it's the same thing with animated TV shows. You can't have someone firing a gun directly at the screen for the same reason. I wonder if they had a similar rule, because the way they do it now is either that same shot now with like sort of relaxed standards, and maybe our tastes in these scenes go. I'd imagine they'd either, if they wanted to do that kind of repeating panel, they'd have a low shot. You're in Jason Todd's view. You're looking up at this character, and you see that a lot in the badass kind of shit's about to go down kind of thing, and
<Yes.
laughs> the villain is standing over basically you, the reader. It's not you can still see the victim on the panel, but you're still kind of within that. You're the victim, and maybe the Comics Code blocked that sort of thing from happening. And when you said the other thing they do, like little snapshots, I can just picture lots of little close-ups of as you said, the crowbar, like the grin. There's someone screaming mouth, something Frank Miller would have done, actually, because that's very...
And I'm just looking at another... something that Frank Miller did do was Daredevil, again, the same era. This is the early 80s, when one of the most well-known comic book deaths was when Bullseye killed Elektra in the pages of Daredevil, when Frank Miller came on Daredevil and kind of... but that is a good example, even though we don't see it from Elektra's point of view. Elektra is played by Jennifer Garner in the Bad Movie. Bullseye is the guy with the...
Comics only, that, folks.
That's that thrill that throws everything as a weapon. But and we basically just see Elektra just basically getting whooped. And again, there's not much blood at all, but we see her eyes. She's kind of lifeless and ragged, and we see Bullseye enjoying himself. And one of the most famous is almost a full page panel where he jabs her own sight in her gut, and you see it. Again, there's not much blood, but it's. To go from a page which is quite smaller panels to open it up to a full page of him jabbing the sight, seen through profile, not a silhouette but a profile of it, jabbing it out. And I remember seeing that the first time. That was quite shocking, even though it doesn't show a lot of blood.
No.
Just a simple image like that. And that's one of the beauties of comics, and Scott McCloud talks about this in his book Understanding Comics, is that we fill in the gap, or what's known as the gutter. The gutter is what we call the space between the panels in comic books. And we fill it in as reader, because it's not like a movie. You can't show emotion. So there has to... The artist is kind of the unsung hero in a lot of ways, because they have to be the cinematographer, director, the editor. They have to choose the key scenes. They have to choose the snapshots to
depends
show emotion,
on the balance,
to show
yeah.
increased intensity. Mm.
Not it depends
only
on the writer. That Alan
panel
Moore
panel,
would,
but page to page.
Alan Moore wouldn't give the writer that freedom, or artist that freedom. I think we both know that. And so you're definitely right. Like with the artist having that responsibility, but I'd say less and less. It seems like you look at scripts these days, and the writer will set out where they want the camera to be, where they want the shot. You know, the punch coming in from left or the right. You know, the more they put a lot of detail into it. And it's interesting to watch experiments where the artist is given more free rein, because I think a lot of writers try and overwrite when they should let the artist have a bit more. You can get wonderful results if the writer overwrites, as we've both seen many. But
that's true.
Yeah,
and it does depend on the pairing. Like you said, we three, Grant Morrison knows Frank Quitely's abilities, so he'll let him run right. I'm just looking again at The Killing Joke by Alan Moore, as you mentioned, and the page where. Barbara Gordon, who's just retired as Batgirl, gets shot in the gut by the Joker.
Right.
Again, it doesn't show a lot. I mean, there's no blood, but there is a bit of blood.
They show it later
it's
on the
graphic.
Yeah, they show it later on the ride. If you remember, if you flip forwards, it's the still shots which kind of take the place of those panels later on. because they're almost like little panels. The photos are little panels within the larger panel. It's almost like stuff he couldn't put on the comic. He got away with putting in photos in very, very tight close-up. And the tight close-up is another subjective tool to bring you right in. Before we go any further, I will probably just define what I mean by subjective and objective. An objective action scene as opposed to a subjective. An objective, you're outside of the action. You're kind of viewing the ballet of two combatants. A subjective, you're brought into it. You're not necessarily within the person's view, but you see things how they see it, or it's skewed by their perspective. So like an analogy I thought up was, it's a video game one, and everyone's played a first or third person action game before. You know, either you're inside the character or the camera's behind their head. Those are both subjective views. You're viewing things how the player is. You're projecting yourself into them so you feel the emotional impact more. The other objective view would be something like Mortal Kombat. You're viewing the characters side by side. You're not quite within it. You're like
distant.
You're distanced from it. And I think that's something you see in the older comics we brought up before. It's objective. You're outside of that action. And like the Jason Todd example, whereas you look at the Killing Joke, there's a shot where I think it's just after the action of him shooting her, and it's him reaching down towards the reader, like you're in Barbara Gordon's view looking up at him.
Okay.
I think he's holding the camera. I can't recall. There's a panel of it. And that's the sort of subjective view you see a lot. And you see more of it since the 80s. But I don't want to make the mistake of saying that all American comics are this way, because even in film, like if you think of like 1950s American films, you might think very static camera angles, not a lot of movement. But then you have like great films like Carol Reed's The Third Man, which has some very innovative kind of shots which sort of pull you in. And comic artists were doing the same thing, even like in the 50s, you know, there were guys who were ahead of the curve. And say in the 80s, Frank Miller was ahead of the curve against a lot of his compatriots. And it's interesting, I don't know how the Comics Code affected Dark Knight Returns, but I imagine they would have released that without the Comics Code. Would that be correct?
Oh, I've actually got the Omnibus edition in my hands right now, and I'm not sure, but I would imagine so.
My guess is yes, because what I read about the marketing said they were saying it's like an adult thing. But what does it say in the Omnibus?
Well, I'm just trying to find a gallery of the original covers, but I think you might be right.
I think they cut off the actual like barcode and stuff off the galleries, don't they, normally? All that stuff.
Yes.
Yeah. But...
Yeah, The Dark Knight Returns, 1986, Frank Miller, Batman has come out of retirement to fight, well, everybody. And, yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I'm just looking at the Batman-Superman fight, and you kind of see this is something that Jeff Loeb used when he launched the Superman-Batman series, mm-hmm. 2004, I think it was. He'll use Superman's point of view and Batman's point of view, so you'll have narrations from both.
Yeah.
So you have these two old guys, Superman and Batman, kind of punching each other, and yeah, you've got like Bruce wrist crushed, ribs moving with a life of their own, and Clark just broke a sweat. Stuff like that. Like it's they're not using the God narration, so to speak, saying he punches him with such thunderous applause that the windows break, but it's from there with own, so we can not only see that he's beat up, but we can hear it in the narration.
It's interesting that and also, what you're saying, that narration, it's mirrored by who he's chosen to frame in each panel, because when he uses a single character's narration, it's usually their, not their point of view, but you might see a tight close-up of their face. And that's a choice of which panel to follow on from which panel, because, I mean, in, say, a objective kind of approached action scene, and this isn't strictly for all of it, they're very kind of loose categories I'm applying here. I mean, an action scene might go like an action, then a reaction, you know, and that doesn't have to be two panels, that can occur in one panel. Sorry, you might see, so I got a bit excited with my hands there, I was thinking of punching. No, like the shot might show the character swinging his fist, and either in the same panel you'll see the other character like being knocked back, or in the next panel you see, in say in a Frank Miller example, the action reaction is the action might be a tight close up, but it's obvious that Batman is swinging a punch. You know, just on his face, you can see his grittiness. And the second shot is say Superman's head sort of snapping back and grimacing. You know, that's the action reaction. And a lot of other comics, which are like where the fighting isn't as important for the characters. You'll just see action. Especially, say, in group fights. Say, pick out maybe an X-Men comic, maybe from the 90s, might find a good example. In a group fight, they'll sort of flick between the different characters fighting in different panels, and you'll just see a series of actions, characters leaping towards each other. It's typical in Image comics, if you remember. You might see two characters leaping towards each other, but no one's hit anyone. They're both snarling, they've both got their fists up, and they're both going, rah. But
there's lots of talking. Yeah,
there's no struggle.
That was huge in the 90s when the artists were the celebrities, and every comic had like massive fight scenes.
Yes.
And it's interesting, even in the 80s, when you look at, like, say, Crisis on Infinite Earths, or the big crossovers that Marvel and DC did, when, you'll have, like, you know, Captain America about to punch someone in the head, and they're both kind of shouting, there's exclamation marks everywhere, and they seem to get out, like, some huge exposition with each punch.
Yeah.
And it kind of looks awkward by today's standards.
I think that's a great case of kind of an objective thing, because you could admire kind of the coolness of the choreography, but you don't feel any kind of real struggle going on, so it's a bit disengaging. So you can look at it and go, that's awesomely drawn, and look at the way, you know... Because you think of, like, teens who really were digging... Sorry, those Image comics. It was how cool the characters were.
And how many punches were thrown.
Yeah, it's not... and it doesn't make for an exciting action scene. It makes for a cool one, if that makes sense.
Yeah, one that looks good, it goes all way too long.
Yeah.
One that's done well is actually Kingdom Come, 1996, I believe it was. DC, written by Mark Waid and artist extraordinaire painter Alex Ross, another DC set future where the retired heroes come back. That's full of fight scenes, and one of the lead characters, who's the kind of everyman, is a Reverend Norman Ross, based on Alex Ross's own father. And the last few issues, he kind of quotes Revelation as these superheroes are fighting each other.
No wonder you love it.
There's one here where, from his point of view, he's seeing Superman come to save the day from all the horror of the bad guys that are coming to blow up the world. And he says, without a word, my spectral guide opens all horizons to me at once. I see the air scorch in Superman's wake. I see the dawning horror in Wonder Woman's eyes. I see Ragnarok at last unfold. And that's across two pages. So there's a lot of silent panels mixed in there, but the editing of the pictures plus the narration of that text that I just read out works together so well. It's an objective point of view. It's his point of view. He's not in the fight scene. He's just witnessing it as we are. But it's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
Just to kind of describe what we're seeing in a greater way.
Yeah, I mean, I know you and I would differ on this, and we really should do an episode where we bicker on this comic. I need to reread it again because it's been too long. Because I don't have the investment in the characters, so I sort of view it as an outsider. But you're right; it is fairly kind of objective in the way it's approached, because there are so many characters, and you can't invest yourself in any. Well, you can invest yourself in a few of them, but because there are so many. But I think of the action scenes in that, and they are. There's no kind of clarity between action to action. I remember there's a scene where some young punk superheroes. That's what it was about, wasn't it? Young superheroes were too rough, and they're causing some damage and fighting each other in the city. But the arrangement of panel to panel is very because it's so detailed. It's difficult to get a sense of rhythm from the fight. So it is a series of actions, but no reactions. So you can't tell kind of who's struggling and who's winning is almost a challenge in that, because there are so many characters. But
that's a good point. And that can be a problem with a lot of these kind of crossovers where Marvel and DC have so many superheroes, and every year they'll basically do a crossover where everybody fights everybody else. I think Marvel did the most recent one that was done well was Civil War, where Captain America and Iron Man fought each other, and then they based the Marvel Ultimate Alliance 2 game on it, where the Superhero Registration Act came out, and they were wise enough to not have everybody fighting, but just the main, you know, half a dozen good guys, half a dozen good guys who didn't agree with those other good guys fighting each other. And that was filled with some just amazing fight scenes that worked really, really well. But it is, because we see superhero fight scenes a lot, but not necessarily as much now. Like, again, as I was saying in the intro, just reading, you know, the last few months' comics, they won't have a big fight like they did in the 90s. Like, in the 90s, there'll be like a five- or six-page fight just for the heck of it. Every American action film has to have a car blowing up. You know, in the 90s, every superhero comic had to have a six-page fight scene. But now you'll have a lot of dialogue, a lot of building up to it, and then you might just have a page or even half a page. Or it's not about the fight necessarily, because superhero comics are monthly. They have to keep it going for, ever. So they'll build up the suspense, they'll build up the intrigue, they'll build up, ooh, he's in this state, I wonder what's going to happen next. The fight has to be the payoff, so they have to kind of, as readers, they have to invest us emotionally until we get to that point. But yeah, there's very few long punching scenes in superhero comics these days, which even I found quite surprising as I was researching today's episode.
Yeah, I was going to ask, I guess, how many... My main memory of comics from the 90s are a lot of double splash pages of about 20 different people flying into each other, usually fairly ordered, like you can see who's fighting who, and like it's usually, they just pair up and they fight in pairs, you know? And I sort of wonder how much of that still happens?
Not really, but I was thinking the death of Superman happened, 1992, in Superman 75. Again, another mainstream-focused death issue. But when I was... watching the recent animated adaptation that they did a couple of years ago, there was a documentary on it where they were talking about the creation of the comic itself, and they talked with all the original writers and artists in the 90s that created The Death of Superman. And they were it was actually quite interesting, because what they'd do in the six issues leading up to it, they'd make with Superman had to fight Doomsday, who's this big thorny muscular Kryptonian creature. They do every issue the panel count per page would be greater to build the suspense over the month. So the first issue would be six panels on a page. The next month it would be five panels, then four, then three, to kind of build that tension until the last issue was every... I don't know if you read...
I have read that one,
but you might remember that every page is one panel.
One panel, yeah.
And it actually, it's quite impactful. Like, it really has... Well, yeah, it's an impact... as much as the guy's punches. And it actually really, really works. And I think that was the first, and perhaps I don't think it's been done again, last time, where that editing choice and that suspense was built up over not only a number of pages, but a number of months. And it seemed to work. But, yeah.
I think that's an ideal time to talk about how panels work to speed up an action. I mean, we did mention Frank Miller before, and the way he uses panels is quite clever, and it's a similar thing to what you've just described. He works in a bunch of very, very tight close-ups. You know, just in his normal scenes, he uses the same technique as he does in his action, slightly adjusted. And then there'll be explosions of splash panels, which will be the moment for you to take a breath, because you're rushing through these small sections, and then there's deep breath... And then you're back into this tight action. It pulls you back in, because he breaks it down into smaller panels and then the tight panels again. And it's his way of controlling the rhythm of these fight scenes and keeping them interesting, because, I mean, he does write a lot of fight scenes, but his aren't boring, if you know what I mean.
No.
And it is for those reasons of, the rhythm pulling you into the character. But I wanted to mention, let's cross the Atlantic, or for us... it's on this side of the Atlantic, so I shouldn't use that that phrase. I'm not American, so
across the Pacific, haven't I?
Not really. No. Across the ocean. Oh, we do cross a bit of the Pacific. Indian? No, I don't know. manga obviously has a long tradition of action in its comics, and you can probably there's certain innovations that occurred in manga. I don't want to say they strictly occurred prior to American comics, but you did see they were maybe adapted, kind of embraced more by the mainstream manga artists quicker than it happened in the West. And I mean, in Frank Miller's case, he directly saw manga and he was like, oh, that's cool, why aren't we doing it this way, because it makes sense, kind of thing. But I'm not saying it's better or anything, so just getting that disclaimer out there now, even though I think it is better. Kidding. But there's quite a few manga which focus on action. I went back to one which is one of my favorites and probably the best action manga or best action comic I can think of. It is War to War action. It is Akira. I mean, this the six volume tome, psychic children, Tokyo is destroyed a total of three times over the course of time. Yeah, it's pretty insane. And just looking through it again, I see how sort of cleverly controlled he does the action. So in a scene where he is just random characters confronting what's this kind of walking tank thing, and like the first panel you get a sense of how far they are away from each other. Then the second panel you see the subjective view of the guy in the tank. It's not you're not strictly in the tank, but you're viewing the guys from above. And the next panel is like behind the characters looking up at this thing. You sense where they are in ratio to each other, which is important for any fight scene. You have to know the geography of where they are, and yep. A lot of artists don't do that. And then he'll start to go into a lot more tricks and breaking up the panels. He does the similar thing to Frank Miller again. The speed at which panels, the narrowness of the panels, which is an interesting trick, just making them very tall and narrow. And also as tension builds, what started off as fairly like polar angled, 90 degree, 0 degree. Frames, even if they're sort of haphazardly arranged, starts to break, so it's just a slight angle, and then eventually to the point of it builds up over a series here over 20 pages to the point where the panels kind of just lose all their shape. And it's a interesting technique, which it's curious to see it controlled so well, because I look at a lot of other comics and a lot of other manga which aren't done as well, and it's just random. Just random collection of panels at different angles. And also what's can you think of any other examples which talk on that?
Yeah, I'm just thinking of J.H. Williams III, when he does Batwoman, and he did Seven Soldiers. When he did Batwoman, he would like incorporate the bat symbol into the panels, say, will form the shape of the bat symbol. But yeah, when he does the fight scenes, he'll just go nuts. And I know Neil Adams experimented with that a bit when he did X-Men briefly in the 70s, I think it was, where he'll do almost like long triangular shaped panels going over the two pages. So it's not standard, say, square rectangular panels. It's basically just to show the chaos, to show the dynamism of all these characters moving. So he'll show like beasts jumping, and it'll be jumping down, and then it'll be a collection of like little diamond or triangular shaped panels around his legs, kind of stuff.
That makes sense.
And J.H. Williams III does that a lot as well. So it is very different. It looks greater, but it's almost like a sense of like you're getting. And I know anime does this as well. Even on shows like, say, Batman: The Brave and the Bold, where they'll show, a close up of all the speed lines. So they'll just show a close up of, a fist hitting a chin, and then a foot hitting a face, and they'll just break that down. So it's almost slow motion-y.
Yeah,
that doesn't get used a lot in American comics, but I'm guessing it is. Yeah, very manga-y.
That is curious to watch the difference, because as you were saying, that it adds a dynamism to an action scene, but a lot of artists just put skewed panels on everything, even in characters are talking, thinking it'll add interest to the page, when that shouldn't be how they're structuring it. They're doing it kind of, they're starting off with something weak and then trying to stack tricks on without understanding how they work to make something work.
I guess it depends what you're trying to achieve. Like J.H. Williams, for example, it's obvious that he's a designer. And I suppose you could say even the same for, say, Jonathan Hickman. So look at the nightly news that he did. It shows action as well, but in a static way. And it's perhaps not as successful because we are used to the smaller panels followed by a larger panel whatever. But it looks good. Even if it doesn't tell a story, even if it doesn't take us through a linear time frame, it looks good on the page and it still conveys the action. It's just not in a filmic, cinematic way that we're used to.
That is interesting, because you do see some comics take on the filmic aspect. They frame their panels like storyboards, so they think in terms of what's the main movement here. I guess they're not thinking in terms of how a comic works, because in a film you're only viewing one panel, one frame at a time, and there's how many is it a second? Like 52, 60, oh, 24, sorry, 24 frames a second.
Yeah.
I'm thinking like Blu-ray probably or something. 24 frames a second. And in comics, the frames, they are all skewed, but you are on a page and you're viewing all these aspects of a fight at once, so the page, the whole page is that piece of choreography, not just each individual frame, which is like, say, a foot, hand. The whole page you take in is the fight. And
You're right. And talking about cinematic and also talking about manga, Nemesis by Mark Miller and Steve McNiven, the guys that worked on Civil War that I mentioned earlier.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just looking at this. Well, it's almost like a four-page fight. The speed lines everywhere, how you were saying before, like there's not a lot of detail. It's almost, and superhero comics tend to do this unless they're, you know, throwing something into a building. But as soon as the fight starts, the background detail kind of blurs away.
That's interesting.
It's not
yeah.
as important. And it, Nemesis, I'm just looking at Nemesis, what's this, issue 3, and it's one of the bloodiest fights I've seen. Basically, it's a white-clad bad guy who doesn't really have any superpowers, but he's bored, so he wants to kill the top cops around the world. It's been turned into a movie directed by Tony Scott, but yeah, I don't know how they're going to put this in a movie. Anyway, and it's basically three, four pages silent of him, of the bad guy, just taking out a whole SWAT team.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, he's kicking one guy, and then there's a close-up of him with... We see him punching someone, but we just see the blood from that someone and a hand in the corner. We see him, you know, jumping over, and then he's got a baton in each hand, and he's stabbing them down into two guys' eyes. There's a lot of baton stabbing into people's...
It's like we're back in the 90s again.
It does very much feel like that. And then the last page is, you know, him standing over with a baton going behind, through someone's, the back of his neck and out of his mouth with two teeth on the floor, lifeless eyes and blood spilling. So it's kind of like... three pages of chaotic, utterly chaotic, smaller panels, and then the last panel, the big finish, is a four-page panel of him crouching over a lifeless cop. That's taken to the extreme, and it does show the chaos and the movement very well. Like, it's obvious that because they're silent, you flick through these pages quickly, and they only show you the briefest glimpses of what's happening. Okay, this guy's getting killed, but it does work. It's very much over the top because that's what this comic is going for.
Mm-hmm.
But it works.
I'll get back to what you briefly mentioned, backgrounds, and I want to talk about that in a sec. But I do want to mention another comic which is also has a lot of ultraviolence in terms of exploding heads, teeth, you know, all that stuff. And Grant Morrison, Frank Quitely's We Three, which I mentioned before.
Yes.
Now, this has some of kind of the best action scenes I've seen in a long time, and I always forget when I come back to it, but the way Quietly will use sort of silent panels, which might just be a panel of red, just of nothing, to sort of punctuate sections. There's an amazing panel where the cat's moving so fast, and while it's attacking these soldiers and slaughtering them, you know, cutting their heads off and all that. I should mention, if you've forgotten, these are armored animal military experiments. It's going so fast that it's exited the panels. The panels are kind of arranged vertically on the page, like you've exited comic space and gone into the fifth dimension, which is very Grant Morrison. But it's moving so fast that the panels even can't contain it. It's escaping the borders. Escaping the borders is another technique you see kind of in the well-armed arsenal of a good action comics artist.
And That's true.
Yeah, this comic has so many different techniques on show. A single panel with a large piece of action in the background, and then a whole bunch of little reaction panels,
yes,
tiny
that's
ones.
That's the page that I remember.
Yeah, tiny, tiny little reaction panels. Like the cat, the background panel has the cat firing his little claws, and every single reaction shot is a little blade killing a soldier, like in close up. Like there's one of just a guy's thumbnail splitting in two, and it just it's quite so it's very much more striking than it would have been just to show a large, maybe a splash page panel of the cat in one end and all these guys falling apart into pieces. But that's the kind of comic it is, and which I suppose is closer maybe to the that Nemesis comic you mentioned. Was that like a large splash panel, or was that a series of panels? I missed that.
It was a series of panels over three pages, followed by one big splash page.
Yeah, the splash pages, a well-used splash page makes the difference between a great memorable action scene and one which just kind of whimpers away.
Yes.
And I noticed, especially with older comics, if you look back on, I'm not saying their weaknesses of, say, Jack Kirby's work, because he didn't use too many splash panels, early on. But you notice when you reread those, the effect is lessened somewhat of the
fight scene. They relied, it's true, I think action scenes in today's comics work a lot better. Even though I think Kirby was the master of showing a static shot of someone in action, like capturing a moment of action, Captain America throwing a shield, for example, or whatever. His characters always seem to be on the move. But, you know, I also think, say, Stan Lee, back in the day, he always seemed to rely on narration a lot.
Yeah, too much.
Yeah, like Spider-Man is lifting. Will he be able to, you know, that kind of stuff?
That's yeah, and that's a great
unnecessary because the art is showing it.
I had a I'd noted that one. That's the Ditko scene where he's lifting that engine and the room's filling with water. And yes. that's an amazing action scene, but it doesn't need the narration at all. And that's left over from the old technique where everything's narrated. I mean, I was looking through this Batman comic from the 50s, and it's describing that he punches him, and that he's like it's written more nicely than that. But I can see he's punching him, and that he's moving fast. I'm guessing part of it is that they suspected that their artists weren't up to the challenge. And if we're both being honest here, yeah.
I think it was also the publishers expected that if people consumers just bought a comic that kids. Didn't have a whole lot of words on it, yeah, they felt ripped off. But also, they were like, where's all the words, you know? They felt, which is kind of weird. Like, you know, when you're buying a Brian Michael Bendis comic, you're getting your money's worth because it's so wordy.
Yeah.
But I guess perhaps there was some of that in that day. But yeah, you're right also that perhaps...
kids are dumb.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and back in those days...
comics were a new thing.
Yeah. Kids were reading comics, than they are. You know, comics aren't a lot for kids these days necessarily.
I wonder if we take it for granted, like being able to read these, because I know first time questions I hear a lot, like people don't know where to start on a page, like if the panels are a bit crazy.
I've heard that, and you see again a technique they don't use so much. I guess this is actually because it's motion, letting your eye lead through the page. Automatically, we go from top left. To bottom right when we read.
Yeah.
But yeah, exactly. I've had the same people asking me. And back in the 80s, they used to put arrows indicating what panel is next.
That's not good for an action scene because it kills it. Your momentum should be, the way the characters are facing should draw you along. So the action should be on the left, the reaction should be on the right, unless if you want to break the rhythm, in which case the reaction's somewhere else on the page. And... it's a subtle thing, and it's not something you really notice while you're reading. But if the characters are all facing the opposite way of the flow of the eye movement, like the action reaction, like you're reading the reaction and then the action, it destroys the momentum, which is something I noticed with Blade of the Immortals, a manga series out of Japan, quite a good one. A lot of action. It's kind of a like, pseudo samurai story with assassins, and there's this guy who has like worms in his body which keep him alive, even though he's not a very good fighter. So yeah, just thought I'd mention it because it's not very well known. But it's not a criticism of the comic itself; it's of the translation technique. Because what they've done, you know how manga reads right to left, you start the back, you move the front. What they've done because they wanted to make it read left to right is they've flipped it, but they flipped each panel. So his left arm still is left arm, like because what they did with Akira is everyone's left-handed, just because it keeps the flow from being destroyed. Okay. Do you know what I mean? But in this case, everyone's say if there's an action scene, it's against the flow of your reading, and you really notice it when it's the wrong way around because you can tell. Okay, he knows what he's doing, but this has completely destroyed the effect of how this should work. Does that make sense?
It does, yeah. Yeah.
And you notice it when it's done wrong, and when it's done right, you take it for granted a bit, which I sort of did with We Three the first time I read it. I took it for granted. Now I appreciate it.
I wanted to mention Scott Pilgrim, especially the last volume, and there's a lot of action in Scott Pilgrim where he's fighting people, and it's interesting, again, very manga-inspired, a lot of speed lines, that kind of stuff, and very few panels per page. Like, it's surprising how many... There's just two or three panels per page, but Brian Lee O'Malley, he leads the eye very easily, and I think a wise placing of a letter balloon or a speech bubble or a caption can do that, because we automatically want to look at a picture and then I guess read text. So if there's like a bit of narration overlapping a couple of panels or whatever, we can lead our eye that. But Brian Lee O'Malley does that leading very well. There's never any confusion of what panel to read next, and I guess that's why it's kind of hit off so well with comic book newbies, comic book novices, I guess. And I also did want to mention comedy.
Before we get into that, could I mention that background thing? Otherwise, I'll forget to do it completely.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And just because I was on manga a few seconds ago, a technique that you see in manga and not really in Western comics at all is the use of the background. And again, that's a subjective tool. you know, distilled to its essence is just the speed lines, you know, because the character's moving so fast, and because you're moving with them, it's blurred to you as well.
And it does work.
It really does, and it's been adapted by Western comics. I think at first there was
like Scott Pilgrim,
Yeah, and even superhero comics. It doesn't have to be a page of lines. It can be, you can be in a corridor, and the corridor will be lined, so you feel like you're moving through it. There's subtle ways to do it, and you see it again in every form in Akira, because it's six tome series, so he does literally every single angle you could possibly imagine, but. It's that subjective thing versus objective. The flashes. I've seen, say, old Flash comics. They won't use the background. They might just be a single color, or it's the background will be static, so you might not feel how fast he's going.
It's interesting because I started reading comics in the 90s, and that was when Mark Waid was on the Flash, and later Impulse, which was a spin-off title, and. That was when computers first started to be used in a major way in the colouring and production of comics. And that was when the Flash first started having, say, blurry backgrounds. Like, in Photoshop, you could have different levels.
Yeah.
And everybody knows that you can blur something quite easily with Photoshop. So they'll have the Flash, they have speed lines coming from his body, the Flash will be running at you, and then the background, like a cityscape or whatever. So instead of just filling the black background only with speed lines, they'll put a full... cityscape,
blurred,
or if he's running across water, and they'll blur it. They'll make it out of focus, so it does actually look like a movie, and it looks like he's running past. There's a sense of perspective and depth of field, and those Flash comics, and that's a technique that obviously they'll still use today, and that works really, really well. But also back in the, as you said, back in the 50s and 60s, what they used to do to show motion, which is a form of action with the Flash. Again, something they use today was they'll show multiple flashes on the
on
one
the
page.
Same panel. Yeah,
yeah. So there's a they'll also show, say, something like frozen in time. We see that in the first Spider-Man film, where you know, like where he's fighting the bully and he sees everything in slow motion.
Right.
That's a technique that has been used, you know, for decades in comics. So I think I seem to recall there's a classic Flash one where. He's just got his powers. Barry Allen has just been struck by lightning, and he goes to catch a plate that is falling with like some peas and a knife and fork, and it's almost like it's suspended in midair, you know, little peas, drops of milk. And he's, you know, so little things like that are good. They also use the multiple versions of characters in the same panel. Something like Spider-Man, where he's swinging through the city, you'll see like the colors will get lighter and lighter.
I've seen a lot in the in 80s comics, which is interesting. Yeah, I remember panels of just Nightwing flipping around. So you got you got the arc of his movement, so you could see him do the whole... And it's probably the same thing with Spider-Man.
Yeah, a lot of the acrobatic characters. And again, that works well. And they'll use the colouring to get darker and darker through the page, so you know what comes first.
Which is first. And that's curious, because that's definitely not a filmic technique. It's not something you see in films. It's something you can only see in a comic, whereas the speed line background or the background which is blurring around is taken directly from film, because that's not strictly how you personally see things when you're when you're moving. It's more of like backgrounds are a haze because you're not focusing on them. It's a, something taken from film, whereas I guess the multiple person in a panel thing. And yeah, I've got examples of it here occurring in a 60s Batman comic. So it's quite an old technique that they were throwing in there. I'd be curious to see what the roots of that are. But I mean, yeah, just and not just speed lines, just setting where a panel's taking from. Like you were saying, if the background's hazy, you're focusing on the characters. But as a scene of punctuation here in Akira, a character gets shot, for example, and all of a sudden the background comes into very, very sharp focus, incredibly detailed, and the characters are as detailed in the panel as well. But it's just a different form of punctuation, which is the opposite of, say, if there's lots of detail, and then all of a sudden it's a white background with characters floating in it, which you see as well. So, yeah.
That's true.
Yeah. But, I mean, yeah, there's a lot of action manga. A good one right now is Vagabond. I've mentioned it before, Takahiko Inoue. And that's all, like, forest landscapes. You can't use, like, sharp geometric effects to kind of have characters flying through, which is more which can be more effective. But the characters are a bit more like in Lone Wolf and Cub, in that they're blurred while moving through a space. You got that combination of tight close-ups again. And, yeah, just another different example. I was interested by the Scott Pilgrim example you mentioned, because the film uses something from that as well, which is the use of the words.
Giant sound effects, incorporating the sound effects into the action.
Onomatopoeia, thank you.
Like even while the Batman 60s TV show was a classic sound. But that wouldn't show the pictures on side or the action. It would cut to a black screen with Biff. Well, that only.
And that's something that's, again, probably comics have to somehow show you sound, whereas in a novel you can write the sound was deafening or something. And, I mean, in the earliest comics they would have written that, and then eventually they go, well, how can we make this more sophisticated and not, you know... And then,
well, yeah, Kingdom Come now, it's got crack-a-boom with a big exclamation mark, huge letters, it's in red, and it's obvious that it's an explosion. But that's true, I hadn't thought about that, but lettering is very important.
It's part of the whole page design, and I keep coming back to Frank Miller, but like there's great examples of he'll have a sound effect spanning several panels, and there's that continuation through a scene of just like... you've seen it a lot. Say, Joker, you always see the ha, 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 and that'll sometimes stretch across several panels, and that's quite an effective action tool there. I was thinking of a recent example which uses words quite interestingly. Mesmo Delivery Service.
Raphael Grampa.
Yep. Check it out if you haven't. It's a cool little indie book.
Sure is.
And he uses onomatopoeia, quite vigorously. There's the normal examples of giant boom and crack, just to pull your eye along. But there's a great series of pages where the kind of rockabilly characters like cutting down these gas station douchebags, and the lyrics of A Little Less Conversation sort of swirling across the background in giant pink letters, and it's this weird little subjective tool that pulls you into his head rather than being hearing a boom or a crack. He's got this internal monologue which is just an Elvis song. It's the strangest thing, and like nothing I've ever seen. Like, you sometimes see lyrics maybe like is a speech bubble in a song.
Yes.
But it's a quite unusual technique. Not something I recall seeing in a comic to this level.
Yeah, there probably is, but I can't seem to recall any at the moment. But you're right.
Not to this extent. I'm sure I've seen lyrics used around characters, but there isn't even a radio. It's just coming from his inner space and projecting into the outer space of him killing these people. Whew, man. But I guess, overall thoughts, Chris?
Briefly, I just want to mention comedy.
Oh, sorry.
The importance of timing, and not only Scott Pilgrim, but The Goon by Eric Powell and Atomic Robo, which is published by Red 5, which is very funny. And I guess not necessarily action or motion, but timing. There's not a heap of funny comics out there, but I think that's just the emotion on the page is very hard to get right. It's hard to do comedy on the page in the comic, The Goon and Atomic Robo are very good at showing that motion, because obviously it's physical comedy.
I think we could do a whole show about this, if I'm being honest.
Yeah, we should. That's a good point.
I
think comics have to use every tool in their arsenal to do the same techniques as film, because they understand that's an entirely different medium. Just to be a designer as well as an artist, you can achieve a lot of good action and motion and suspense, and not just violence, even though that's necessarily what we think of, but to show characters running or jumping or swinging on a rope, bad artists will draw, say, Spider-Man swinging on a web, and he won't look like he's in motion. It will look like he's just kind of standing there or just...
I think you can have a very static panel. Even Frank Quitely, he doesn't use, say, too many speed lines or anything, but it's how you juxtapose all those panels on the page. If they think in terms of the whole page and how that movement works and how you're kind of manipulated, then it's very kind of effective. And when they just are throwing tricks... you can tell when there's not a lot of thought behind it, I find.
Yeah. But, Yeah, which happened a lot in the 90s. But thankfully, we are beyond that.
Are we?
Sure.
Sure, why not?
Most of us are. Yeah. Well, the creators are. Mm. I think they've learned their mistakes.
Mm. I mean, the only style, I was just thinking of creators, I just wanted to briefly mention, the only kind of action you don't see too much of in Western comics is cars, which is something you see a lot of in manga. I mean, you look at a comic like Initial D, which you may have heard of, which is about like car racing, drifting down a mountain kind of thing.
Yep.
And also other things like Akira has all these motorbike scenes and stuff, and it's not something you really ever see in...
That is true.
Yeah.
If you see people chasing each other running, it's usually, people with capes chasing after one another.
Flying through the air or swinging through the air, you know.
Yeah. Batman's again, The Flash did this very well, where bad guys and good guys would chase each other, and you kind of see snapshots in the background. So you'd see the Statue of Liberty in one panel, then you'd see, say, the Egyptian pyramids in the next panel, just to kind of give a sense of quick movement across the globe. Mm. But yeah, you're right. There's not car chases in American comics.
Yeah, I just thought it was something curious, and I was like, that's almost something. Maybe we don't like drawing cars as much. I don't know.
Well, we can always watch the Fast and Furious movie to get that fixed.
Yeah, that's true. I guess we've shown there's a lot of different techniques, and they're all effective in their own way. Speed lines to motion blurs to subjective objective, all that. And even the old bit of narration can be effective here and used in the right context, like you gave some examples earlier.
It can work, like in Kingdom Come, and it can work, for sure. Yeah,
absolutely. And I think we've exhausted the topic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening. If you want to hear all of our previous episodes, you can go to extrasequential.com, iTunes, and Mixcloud. My blog is comicbookjesus.com. If you want to email us, please do so. If you want to suggest a theme, as someone suggested last week's theme, 1986, which went off very well.
I thought so.
If you want to suggest another theme, I'm sure we'll be doing romance comics as it draws ever closer to Valentine's Day.
Of course. We're not... Yeah, we've got a ringer coming in for that. So,
you've got obviously a better idea about romance, but
you're too manly for again. It. I was going to say you're too manly for romance, but I guess you just spoiled that. So, yeah,
trying to make me look manly. I'm sorry, didn't make it work. Yes.
Oh, I was just going to say I'd like doing these kind of shows. I like really digging into the raw materials.
So you make me think. See, I always panic whenever you suggest a theme because you'd be able
to do it, though. I knew once I got you started, I'd be able to get some insightful stuff out of you, and I did.
So usually, thank you. I'm glad you believed in me.
You think too little of yourself. That's the problem.
I do. I should let others do that. Usually, I guess I don't really have the critical frame of mind, and I haven't been as active in reviewing comics as I normally have been. But I guess you just store up. It's like when you watch a film. You're just so used to watching a film, you can, even though people don't tell you how to watch a film or necessarily, you know what I mean? You know what's going on. Like, people don't have to explain to you. Well, you know how you go to a cinema and you take your friends along with you and they ask you, who's that bad guy? Who's that guy? Yeah, did they just travel back in time? I don't understand. Those are people that don't watch films a lot and you kind of have to explain to them what's going on.
You're definitely not wrong. I heard stories of people. When film was first starting out, it's like people would take their elderly grandparents, and I forget who it was now. It was a particular personal story of his. He took his great grandmother to see a film, and she couldn't actually understand. She's like, "Oh, they made a mistake there. It's suddenly daytime and it was nighttime," and he had to explain, "No. It's a different scene now." So there's this subconscious stuff that you accrue just by watching films, and same way with comics. So stuff which for us is kind of like, oh yeah, that's second nature to us, might not be as obvious on the first read. And a lot of this stuff for me was eye-opening when I first looked at Scott McCloud's Understanding Comics, which is really...
Recommended reading for sure.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And it's an entertaining comic to boot, which is rare.
It's a comic book about comic books.
Yeah, the trifecta. Anyway... Chris said, suggest us some topics. We're not running dry, but I like to hear what people wanted to hear us talk about. So music for the show was at purgeaudit.com.
Thanks for listening as always, everybody. We hope you have an awesome week.
Thanks, everybody.
Catch you on the flip side.
Yeah, you too. See you, buddy.
Bye.